on. If you want to know the truth, we got pretty enthusiastic about it. Even Dean, who ordinarily stood well back from Percy, physically as well as mentally, if he could. None of it that surprising, either, I suppose. For most men, nothing is more flattering than having a young person actually pay attention to his advice, and we were no different in that regard. As a result, not a one of us noticed that Wild Bill Wharton was no longer looking up at the ceiling. That includes me, but I know he wasn't. He was looking at us as we stood there by the duty desk, gassing and giving Percy advice. Giving him advice, and him pretending to listen. Quite a laugh, considering how things turned out. The sound of a key rattling into the lock of the door to the exercise yard put an end to our little post-rehearsal critique. Dean gave Percy a warning glance. "Not a word or a wrong look," he said. "We don't want him to know what we've been doing. It's not good for him. Upsets him." Percy nodded and ran a finger across his lips in a mums-the-word gesture that was supposed to be funny and wasn't. The exercise yard door opened and Delacroix came in, escorted by Brutal, who was carrying the cigar box with a colored spool in it the way the magician's assistant in a vaudeville show might carry the boss's props off stage at the end of the act. Mr. Jingles was perched on Delacroix's shoulder, and Delacroix himself? I tell you what, Lily Langtry couldn't have looked any glowier after performing at the White House. "They love Mr. Jingles," Delacroix proclaimed. "They laugh and cheer and clap their hands." "Well, that's aces," Percy said. He spoke in an indulgent, proprietary way that didn't sound like the old Percy at all. "Pop on back in your cell, old-timer." Delacroix gave him a comical look of distrust, and the old Percy came busting out. He bared his teeth in a mock snarl and made as if to grab Delacroix. It was a joke, of course. Percy was happy, not in a serious grabbing mood at all, but Delacroix didn't know that. He jerked away with an expression of fear and dismay and tripped over one of Brutal's big feet. He went down hard, hitting the linoleum with the back of his head. Mr. Jingles leaped away in time to avoid being crushed and went squeaking off down the green mile to Delacroix's cell. Delacroix got to his feet, gave the chuckling Percy a single hate-filled glance, then scurried off after his pet, calling for him and rubbing the back of his head. Brutal, who didn't know that Percy had shown exciting signs of actually doing his job for a change, gave Percy a wordless look of contempt and went after Del, shaking his keys out. I think what happened next happened because Percy was actually moved to apologize. I know it's hard to believe, but he was in an extraordinary humor that day. If true, it only proves a cynical old adage I heard once, something about how no good deed goes unpunished. Remember me telling you about how, after he'd chased the mouse down to the restraint room on one of those two occasions before Delacroix joined us, Percy got a little too close to the prez's cell? Doing that was dangerous, which was why the Green Mile was so wide. When you walked straight down the middle of it, you couldn't be reached from the cells. The prez hadn't done anything to Percy, but I remember thinking that Arlen Bitterbuck might have, had it been him Percy had gotten too close to. Just to teach him a lesson. Well, the prez and the chief had both moved on, but Wild Bill Wharton had taken their place. He was worse-mannered than the prez or the chief had ever dreamed of being, and he'd been watching the whole little play, hoping for a chance to get on stage himself. That chance now fell into his lap, courtesy of Percy Wetmore.
"Hey, Del!"
Percy called, half-laughing, starting after Brutal and Delacroix and drifting much too close to Wharton's side of the Green Mile without realizing it.
"Hey, you numb shit! I didn't mean nothing by it! Are you all right?"
Wharton was up off his bunk and over to the bars of his cell in a flash. Never in my time as a guard did I see anyone move so fast, and that includes some of the athletic young men Brutal and I worked with later at Boys Correctional. He shot his arms out through the bars and grabbed Percy, first by the shoulders of his uniform blouse and then by the throat. Wharton dragged him back against his cell door. Percy squealed like a pig in a slaughter chute, and I saw from his eyes that he thought he was going to die.
"Ain't you sweet?" Wharton whispered.
One hand left Percy's throat and ruffled through his hair.
"Soft," he said, half laughing, "like a girl's. I'd rather fuck your asshole than your sister's pussy, I think."
And he actually kissed Percy's ear. I think Percy, who had beat Delacroix onto the block for accidentally brushing his crotch, remember, knew exactly what was happening. I doubt that he wanted to, but I think he did. All the color had drained from his face, and the blemishes on his cheeks stood out like birthmarks. His eyes were huge and wet. A line of spittle leaked from one corner of his twitching mouth. All this happened quick. It was begun and done in less than 10 seconds, I'd say. Harry and I stepped forward, our billies raised. Dean drew his gun. But before things could go so much as an inch further, Wharton let go of Percy and stepped back, raising his hands to his shoulders and grinning his dank grin.
"I let him go. I was just playing, and I let him go," he said. "Never hurt every single hair in that boy's pretty head, so don't you go sticking me down that goddamn soft room again."
Percy Wetmore darted across the green mile and cringed against the barred door of the empty cell on the other side, breathing so fast and so loud that it sounded almost like sobbing. He had finally gotten his lesson in keeping to the center of the green mile and away from the frumious bandersnatch, the teeth that bite and the claws that catch. I had an idea it was a lesson that would stick with him longer than all the advice we'd given him after our rehearsals. There was an expression of utter terror on his face, and his precious hair was seriously mussed up for the first time since I'd met him, all in spikes and tangles. He looked like someone who has just escaped being raped. There was a moment of utter stop, then, a quiet so thick that the only sound was the sobbing whistle of Percy's breathing. What broke it was cackling laughter, so sudden and so completely its own mad thing that it was shocking. "Wharton," was my first thought. But it wasn't him. It was Delacroix, standing in the open door of his cell and pointing at Percy. The mouse was back on his shoulder, and Delacroix looked like a small but malevolent male witch, complete with imp.
"Look at him, he done piss his pants!" Delacroix howled. "Look at what the big man done. Boss other people with his stick, maybe. Some mauvais homme, but when someone touch him, he make water in his pants just like a baby."
He laughed and pointed, all his fear and hatred of Percy coming out in that derisive laughter. Percy stared at him, seemingly incapable of moving or speaking. Wharton stepped back to the bars of his cell, looked down at the dark splotch on the front of Percy's trousers. It was small, but it was there, and no question about what it was, and grinned.
"Somebody ought to buy the tough boy a daddy,"
he said, and went back to his bunk, chuffing laughter. Brutal went down to Delacroix's cell, but the Cajun had ducked inside and thrown himself on his bunk before Brutal could get there. I reached out and grasped Percy's shoulder. "Percy," I began, but that was as far as I got. He came to life, shaking my hand off. He looked down at the front of his pants, saw the spot spreading there, and blushed a dark, fiery red. He looked up at me again, then at Harry and Dean. I remember being glad that old Toot Toot was gone. If he'd been around, the story would have been all over the prison in a single day. And given Percy's last name, an unfortunate one in this context, it was a story that would have been told with the relish of high glee for years to come.
"You talk about this to anyone, and you'll all be on the breadlines in a week,"
he whispered fiercely. It was the sort of crack that would have made me want to swat him under other circumstances. But under these, I only pitied him. I think he saw that pity, and it made it worse with him, like having an open wound scoured with nettles. "What goes on here stays here," Dean said quietly. "You don't have to worry about that." Percy looked back over his shoulder toward Delacroix's cell. Brutal was just locking the door, and from inside, deadly clear, we could still hear Delacroix giggling. Percy's look was as black as thunder. I thought of telling him that you reaped what you sowed in this life, and then decided this might not be the right time for a scripture lesson. As for him, he began, but never finished. He left instead, head down, to go into the storage room and look for a dry pair of pants.
"He's so pretty,"
Wharton said in a dreamy voice. Harry told him to shut the fuck up before he went down to the restraint room just on general damned principles. Wharton folded his arms on his chest, closed his eyes, and appeared to go to sleep. Chapter 9. The night before Delacroix's execution came down hotter and muggier than ever. 81 degrees by the thermometer outside the admin ready room when I clocked in at 6. 81 degrees at the end of October, think of that. And thunder rumbling in the west like it does in July. I'd met a member of my congregation in town that afternoon, and he had asked me with apparent seriousness if I thought such unseasonable weather could be a sign of the last times. I said that I was sure not. But it crossed my mind that it was last times for Edouard Delacroix, all right. Yes, indeed it was. Bill Dodge was standing in the door to the exercise yard, drinking coffee and smoking him a little smoke. He looked around at me and said, "Well, look at here, Paul Edgecombe, big as life and twice as ugly." "How'd the day go, Billy?" "All right." "Delacroix?" "Fine. He seems to understand it's tomorrow, and yet it's like he don't understand. You know how most of them are when the end finally comes for them." I nodded. "Wharton?" Bill laughed. "What a comedian. Makes Jack Benny sound like a Quaker. He told Rolf Wedermark that he ate strawberry jam out of his wife's pussy." "What did Rolf say?" "That he wasn't married, said it must have been his mother Wharton was thinking of." I laughed, and hard. That really was funny, in a low sort of way. And it was good just to be able to laugh without feeling like someone was lighting matches way down low in my gut. Bill laughed with me, then turned the rest of his coffee out in the yard, which was empty except for a few shuffling trustees, most of whom had been there for 1,000 years or so. Thunder rumbled somewhere far off, and unfocused heat lightning flashed in the darkening sky overhead. Bill looked up uneasily, his laughter dying. "I'll tell you what, though," he said. "I don't like this weather much. Feels like something's going to happen, something bad." About that he was right. The bad thing happened right around 10:15 that night. That was when Percy killed Mr. Jingles. Chapter 10. At first it seemed like it was going to be a pretty good night, in spite of the heat. John Coffey was being his usual quiet self. Wild Bill was making out to be Mild Bill. And Delacroix was in good spirits for a man who had a date with old Sparky in a little more than 24 hours. He did understand what was going to happen to him, at least on the most basic level. He had ordered chili for his last meal and gave me special instructions for the kitchen.
"Tell him to lay on that hot sauce," he said. "Tell him the kind that really jump up your throat and say howdy. The green stuff. None of that mild. That stuff gripe me like a motherfucker. I can't get off the toilet the next day. But I don't think I'm going to have a problem this time, n'est-ce pas?"
Most of them worry about their immortal souls with a kind of moronic ferocity. But Delacroix pretty much dismissed my questions about what he wanted for spiritual comfort in his last hours. If that fella, Schuster, had been good enough for Big Chief Bitterbuck, Del reckoned Schuster would be good enough for him. No, what he cared about, you've guessed already, I'm sure, was what was going to happen to Mr. Jingles after he, Delacroix, passed on. I was used to spending long hours with the condemned on the night before their last march, But this was the first time I'd spent those long hours pondering the fate of a mouse. Dell considered scenario after scenario, patiently working the possibilities through his dim mind. And while he thought aloud, wanting to provide for his pet mouse's future as if it were a child that had to be put through college, he threw that colored spool against the wall. Each time he did it, Mr. Jingles would spring after it, track it down, and then roll it back to Dell's foot. It started to get on my nerves after a while. First the clack of the spool against the stone wall, then the minute clitter of Mr. Jingles' paws. Although it was a cute trick, it palled after 90 minutes or so. And Mr. Jingles never seemed to get tired. He paused every now and then to refresh himself with a drink of water out of a coffee saucer Delacroix kept for just that purpose, or to munch a pink crumb of peppermint candy, and then back to it he went. Several times it was on the tip of my tongue to tell Delacroix to give it a rest, and each time I reminded myself that he had this night and tomorrow to play the spool game with Mr. Jingles, and that was all. Near the end, though, it began to be really difficult to hold on to that thought. You know how it is with a noise that's repeated over and over like that. After a while, it shoots your nerve. I started to speak, after all. Then something made me look over my shoulder and out the cell door. John Coffey was standing at his cell door across the way, and he shook his head at me. Right? Left? Back to center, as if he had read my mind and was telling me to think again. I would see that Mr. Jingles got to Delacroix's maiden aunt, I said, the one who had sent him the big bag of candy. His colored spool could go as well, even his house. We'd take up a collection and see that Toot gave up his claim on the Corona box. No, said Delacroix, after some consideration. He had time to throw the spool against the wall at least 5 times, with Mr. Jingles either nosing it back or pushing it with his paws. That wouldn't do. Aunt Hermione was too old. She wouldn't understand Mr. Jingles' frisky ways. And suppose Mr. Jingles outlived her? What would happen to him then? No, no. Aunt Hermione just wouldn't do. Well, then, I asked, suppose one of us took it. One of us guards. We could keep him right here on E-Block. No, Delacroix said. He thanked me kindly for the thought, certainly. But Mr. Jingles was a mouse that yearned to be free. He, Edouard Delacroix, knew this because Mr. Jingles had, you guessed it, whispered the information in his ear. All right, I said. One of us will take him home, Del. Dean, maybe. He's got a little boy that would just love a pet mouse, I bet. Delacroix actually turned pale with horror at the thought. A little kid in charge of a rodent genius like Mr. Jingles? How in the name of le bon Dieu could a little kid be expected to keep up with his training, let alone teach him new tricks? And suppose the kid lost interest and forgot to feed him for 2 or 3 days at a stretch? Delacroix, who had roasted 6 human beings alive in an effort to cover up his original crime, shuddered with the delicate revulsion of an ardent anti-vivisectionist. All right, I said I'd take him myself. Promise them anything, remember, in their last 48 hours, promise them anything. How would that be? No, sir, Boss Edgecombe, Del said apologetically. He threw the spool again. It hit the wall, bounced, spun, then Mr. Jingles was on it like white on rice and nosing it back to Delacroix. Thank you kindly, merci beaucoup, but you live out in the woods, and Mr. Jingles, he be scared to live out dans la forêt. I know because... I think I can guess how you know, Del, I said. Delacroix nodded, smiling. But we gonna figure this out, you bet. He threw the spool. Mr. Jingles clittered after it. I tried not to wince. In the end, it was Brutal who saved the day. He had been up by the duty desk watching Dean and Harry play cribbage. Percy was there, too, and Brutal finally tired of trying to start a conversation with him and getting nothing but sullen grunts in response. He strolled down to where I sat on a stool outside of Delacroix's cell and stood there listening to us with his arms folded. How about Mouseville? Brutal asked into the considering silence which followed Dell's rejection of my spooky old house out in the woods. He threw the comment out in a casual, just-an-idea tone of voice. "Mouseville?" Delacroix asked, giving Brutal a look both startled and interested. "What Mouseville?"
"It's this tourist attraction down in Florida," he said. "Tallahassee, I think. Is that right, Paul? Tallahassee?"
"Yep," I said, speaking without a moment's hesitation, thinking, God bless Brutus Howell. "Tallahassee, right down the road a piece from the Dog University." Brutal's mouth twitched at that, and I thought he was going to spoil the pitch by laughing, but he got it under control and nodded. I'd hear about the Dog University later, though, I imagined. This time Dell didn't throw the spool, although Mr. Jingles stood on Dell's slipper with his front paws raised, clearly lusting for another chance to chase. The Cajun looked from Brutal to me and back to Brutal again.
"What they do in Mouseville?" he asked.
"You think they'd take Mr. Jingles?" Brutal asked me, simultaneously ignoring Dell and drawing him on. "Think he's got the stuff, Paul?" I tried to appear considering. "You know," I said, "the more I think of it, the more it seems like a brilliant idea." From the corner of my eye, I saw Percy come partway down the green mile, giving Wharton's cell a very wide berth. He stood with one shoulder leaning against an empty cell, listening with a small, contemptuous smile on his lips.
"What is Mouseville?" Dell asked, now frantic to know.
"A tourist attraction, like I told you," Brutal said. "There's, I don't know, 100 or so mice there, wouldn't you say, Paul?"
"More like 150 these days," I said.
"It's a big success. I understand they're thinking of opening one out in California and calling it Mouseville West, and that's how much business is booming. Trained mice are the coming thing with a smart set, I guess. I don't understand it myself."
Percy sat with the colored spool in his hand, looking at us, his own situation forgotten for the time being.
"They only take the smartest mice," Brutal cautioned, "the ones that can do tricks. And they can't be white mice because those are pet shop mice."
"Pet shop mice, yeah, you bet," Delacroix said fiercely. "I hate them pet shop mice."
"And what they got," Brutal said, his eyes distant now as he imagined it, "is this tent you go into."
Yeah, like in a circ. Do you got to pay to get in?"
"You shitting me? Of course you got to pay to get in. A dime apiece, 2 cents for the kiddies. And there's like this whole city made out of Bakelite boxes and toilet paper rolls and windows made out of isinglass so you can see what they're up to in there."
Yeah.
Delacroix was in ecstasy now. Then he turned to me. "What the ivy glass?
Like on the front of a stove where you can see in?" I said. "Oh, sure, that shit."
He cranked his hand at Brutal, wanting him to go on, and Mr. Jingle's little oil-drop eyes practically spun in their sockets, trying to keep that spool in view. It was pretty funny. Percy came a little closer, as if wanting to get a better look, and I saw John Coffey frowning at him, but I was too wrapped up in Brutal's fantasy to pay much attention. This took telling the condemned man what he wanted to hear to new heights, and I was all admiration, believe me.
"Well," Brutal said, "there's the Mouse City, but what the kids really like is the Mouseville All-Star Circus, where there's mice that swing on trapezes, and mice that roll these little barrels, and mice that stack coins."
"Yeah, that's it. That's the place for Mr. Jingles,"
Delacroix said. His eyes sparkled and his cheeks were high with color. It occurred to me that Brutus Howell was a kind of saint.
"You gonna be a circus mouse after all, Mr. Jingles? Gonna live in a mouse city down Florida, all ivy glass windows, hurrah!"
He threw the spool extra hard. It hit low on the wall, took a crazy bounce, and squirted out between the bars of his cell door and onto the mile. Mr. Jingles raced out after it, and Percy saw his chance.
"No, you fool!"
Brutal yelled, but Percy paid no attention. Just as Mr. Jingles reached the spool, too intent on it to realize his old enemy was at hand, Percy brought the sole of one hard black work shoe down on it. There was an audible snap as Mr. Jingles' back broke, and blood gushed from his mouth. His tiny dark eyes bulged in their sockets, and in them I read an expression of surprised agony
that was all too human. Delacroix screamed with horror and grief. He threw himself at the door of his cell and thrust his arms out between the bars, reaching as far as he could, crying the mouse's name over and over. Percy turned toward him, smiling, toward the three of us. "There," he said. "I knew I'd get him, sooner or later. Just a matter of time, really." He turned and walked back up the Green Mile, not hurrying, leaving Mr. Jingles lying on the linoleum in a spreading pool of his own blood.
Part 4. The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix.
Chapter 1. All this other writing aside, I've kept a little diary since I took up residence at Georgia Pines. No big deal, just a couple of paragraphs a day, mostly about the weather. And I looked back through it last evening. I wanted to see just how long it has been since my grandchildren, Christopher and Danielle, more or less forced me into Georgia Pines. "For your own good, Gramps," they said. Of course they did. Isn't that what people mostly say when they finally figured out how to get rid of a problem that walks and talks? It's been a little over 2 years. The eerie thing is that I don't know if it feels like 2 years, or longer than that, or shorter. My sense of time seems to be melting like a kid's snowman in a January thaw. It's as if time as it always was, Eastern Standard Time, Daylight Saving Time, Working Man Time, doesn't exist anymore. Here there is only Georgia Pines Time, which is Old Man Time, Old Lady Time, and Piss the Bed Time. The rest, all gone. This is a dangerous, damned place. You don't realize it at first. At first you think it's only a boring place, about as dangerous as a nursery school at nap time, but it's dangerous, all right. I've seen a lot of people slide into senility since I came here, and sometimes they do more than slide. Sometimes they go down with the speed of a crash-diving submarine. They come here mostly all right, dim-eyed and welded to the cane, maybe a little loose in the bladder, but otherwise okay, and then something happens to them. A month later, they're just sitting in the TV room, staring up at Oprah Winfrey on the TV with dull eyes, a slack jaw, and a forgotten glass of orange juice tilted and dribbling in one hand. A month after that, you have to tell them their kids' names when the kids come to visit. And a month after that, it's their own damn names you have to refresh them on. Something happens to them, all right. Georgia Pines time happens to them. Time here is like a weak acid that erases first memory, and then the desire to go on living. You have to fight it. That's what I tell Elaine Connolly, my special friend. It's gotten better for me since I started writing about what happened to me in 1932, the year John Coffey came on the Green Mile. Some of the memories are awful, but I can feel them sharpening my mind and my awareness the way a knife sharpens a pencil, and that makes the pain worthwhile. Writing and memory alone aren't enough, though. I also have a body, wasted and grotesque though it may now be, and I exercise it as much as I can. It was hard at first. Old fogies like me aren't much shakes when it comes to exercise just for the sake of exercise. But it's easier now that there's a purpose to my walks. I go out before breakfast, as soon as it's light most days, for my first stroll. It was raining this morning, and the damp makes my joints ache, but I hooked a poncho from the rack by the kitchen door and went out anyway. When a man has a chore, he has to do it, and if it hurts, too bad. Besides, there are compensations. The chief one is keeping that sense of real time as opposed to Georgia Pines time. And I like the rain, aches or no aches. especially in the early morning, when the day is young and seems full of possibilities, even to a washed-up old boy like me. I went through the kitchen, stopping to beg two slices of toast from one of the sleepy-eyed cooks, and then went out. I crossed the croquet course, then the weedy little putting green. Beyond that is a small stand of woods, with a narrow path winding through it and a couple of sheds no longer used and moldering away quietly along the way. I walked down this path slowly, listening to the sleek and secret patter of the rain in the pines, chewing away at a piece of toast with my few remaining teeth. My legs ached, but it was a low ache, manageable. Mostly I felt pretty well. I drew the moist gray air as deep as I could, taking it in like food. And when I got to the second of those old sheds, I went in for a while, and I took care of my business there. When I walked back up the path 20 minutes later, I could feel a worm of hunger stirring in my belly, and thought I could eat something a little more substantial than toast. A dish of oatmeal. Perhaps even a scrambled egg with a sausage on the side. I love sausage, always have. But if I eat more than one these days, I'm apt to get the squitters. One would be safe enough, though. Then, with my belly full and with the damp air still perking up my brain, or so I hoped, I would go up to the solarium and write about the execution of Edouard Delacroix. I would do it as fast as I could, so as not to lose my courage. It was Mr. Jingles I was thinking about as I crossed the croquet course to the kitchen door, how Percy Wetmore had stamped on him and broken his back, and how Delacroix had screamed when he realized what his enemy had done. And I didn't see Brad Dolan standing there, half hidden by the dumpster, until he reached out and grabbed my wrist.
"Out for a little stroll, Polly?"
he asked. I jerked back from him, yanking my wrist out of his hand. Some of it was just being startled. Anyone will jerk when they're startled, but that wasn't all of it. I'd been thinking about Percy Wetmore, remember, and it's Percy that Brad always reminds me of. Some of it's how Brad always goes around with a paperback stuffed into his pocket. With Percy, it was always a men's adventure magazine. With Brad, it's books of jokes that are only funny if you're stupid and mean-hearted. Some of it's how he acts like he's king shit of Turd Mountain, but mostly it's that he's sneaky and he likes to hurt. He'd just gotten to work, I saw. Hadn't even changed into his orderly's whites yet. He was wearing jeans and a cheesy-looking Western-style shirt. In one hand was the remains of a Danish he'd hooked out of the kitchen. He'd been standing under the eave, eating it where he wouldn't get wet. And where he could watch for me. I'm pretty sure of that now. I'm pretty sure of something else as well. I'll have to watch out for Mr. Brad Dolan. He doesn't like me much. I don't know why, but I never knew why Percy Wetmore didn't like Delacroix either. And dislike is really too weak a word. Percy hated Del's guts from the very first moment the little Frenchman came onto the Green Mile.
"What's with this poncho you got on, Polly?" he asked, flicking the collar. "This isn't yours."
"I got it in the hall outside the kitchen," I said. I hate it when he calls me Polly, and I think he knows it, but I was damned if I'd give him the satisfaction of seeing it. There's a whole row of them. I'm not hurting it any. Would you say rain's what it's made for, after all?
"But it wasn't made for you, Polly,"
he said, giving it another little flick.
"That's the thing. Those slickers are for the employees, not the residents."
"I still don't see what harm it does." He gave me a thin little smile.
"It's not about harm. It's about the rules. What would life be without rules?" "Polly, Polly, Polly."
He shook his head as if just looking at me made him feel sorry to be alive.
"You probably think an old fart like you doesn't have to mind about the rules anymore, but that's just not true, Polly."
Smiling at me, disliking me, maybe even hating me, and why? I don't know. Sometimes there is no why. That's the scary part.
"Well, I'm sorry if I broke the rules," I said. It came out sounding whiny, a little shrill, and I hated myself for sounding that way, but I'm old, and old people whine easily. Old people scare easily. Brad nodded.
"Apology accepted. Now go hang that back up. You got no business out walking in the rain anyway, especially not in those woods. What if you were to slip and fall and break your damned hip, huh? Who do you think would have to hoss your freight back up the hill?"
"I don't know," I said. I just wanted to get away from him. The more I listened to him, the more he sounded like Percy. William Wharton, the crazy man who came to the Green Mile in the fall of 32, once grabbed Percy and scared him so bad that Percy wet his pants.
"You talk about this to anyone," Percy told the rest of us afterwards, "and you'll all be on the breadlines in a week."
Now, these many years later, I could almost hear Brad Dolan saying those same words in that same tone of voice. It's as if by writing about those old times I have unlocked some unspeakable door that connects the past to the present. Percy Wetmore to Brad Dolan, Janice Edgecombe to Elaine Connolly, Cold Mountain State Prison to the Georgia Pines old folks' home. And if that thought doesn't keep me awake tonight, I guess nothing will. I made as if to go through the kitchen door, and Brad grabbed me by the wrist again. I don't know about the first one, but this time he was doing it on purpose, squeezing to hurt, his eyes shifting back and forth, making sure no one was around in the early morning wet, no one to see he was abusing one of the old folks he was supposed to be taking care of.
"What do you do down that path?" he asked. "I know you don't go down there and jerk off. Those days are long behind you, so what do you do?"
"Nothing," I said, telling myself to be calm, not to show him how bad he was hurting me, and to be calm, to remember he'd only mentioned the path. He didn't know about the shed.
"I just walk, to clear my mind."
"Too late for that, Polly. Your mind's never going to be clear again."
He squeezed my thin old man's wrist again, grinding the brittle bones, eyes continually shifting from side to side, wanting to make sure he was safe. Brad wasn't afraid of breaking the rules, he was only afraid of being caught breaking them. And in that, too, he was like Percy Wetmore, who would never let you forget he was the governor's nephew.
"Old as you are, it's a miracle you can remember who you are. You're too goddamn old. Even for a museum like this, you give me the fucking creeps, Polly."
"Let go of me," I said, trying to keep the whine out of my voice. It wasn't just pride, either. I thought if he heard it, it might inflame him, the way the smell of sweat can sometimes inflame a bad-tempered dog, one which would otherwise only growl, to bite. That made me think of a reporter who'd covered John Coffey's trial. The reporter was a terrible man named Hammersmith, and the most terrible thing about him was that he hadn't known he was terrible. Instead of letting go, Dolan squeezed my wrist again. I groaned. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. It hurt all the way down to my ankles.
"What do you do down there, Polly? Tell me."
"Nothing," I said. I wasn't crying, not yet, but I was afraid I'd start soon if he kept bearing down like that.
"Nothing, I just walk. I like to walk. Let go of me."
He did, but only long enough so he could grab my other hand. That one was rolled closed.
"Open up," he said. "Let Papa see."
I did, and he grunted with disgust. It was nothing but the remains of my second piece of toast. I clenched it in my right hand when he started squeezing my left wrist, and there was butter, well, oleo, they don't have real butter here, of course, on my fingers.
"Go on inside and wash your damned hands,"
he said, stepping back and taking another bite of his Danish.
"Jesus Christ."
I went up the steps. My legs were shaking, my heart pounding like an engine with leaky valves and shaky old pistons. As I grasped the knob that would let me into the kitchen and safety, Dolan said,
"If you tell anyone I squeezed your poor old wrist, Polly, I'll tell them you're having delusions. Onset of senile dementia, likely. And you know they'll believe me. If they're bruises, they'll think you made them yourself."
Yes, those things were true. And once again, it could have been Percy Wetmore saying them, a Percy that had somehow stayed young and mean while I'd grown old and brittle. "I'm not going to say anything to anyone," I muttered. "Got nothing to say."
"That's right, you old sweetie."
His voice light and mocking, the voice of a lagoon, to use Percy's word, who thought he was going to be young forever.
"And I'm going to find out what you're up to. I'm going to make it my business, you hear?"
I heard, all right, but wouldn't give him the satisfaction of saying so. I went in, passed through the kitchen. I could now smell eggs and sausage cooking, but no longer wanted any, and hung the poncho back up on its hook. Then I went upstairs to my room, resting at every step, giving my heart time to slow, and gathered my writing materials together. I went down to the solarium and was just sitting at the little table by the windows when my friend Elaine poked her head in. She looked tired, and I thought unwell. She'd combed her hair out but was still in her robe. We old sweeties don't stand much on ceremony. For the most part, we can't afford to.
"I won't disturb you," she said. "I see you're getting set to write."
"Don't be silly," I said. "I've got more time than Carter's got liver pills. Come on in." She did, but stood by the door.
"It's just that I couldn't sleep again, and happened to be looking out my window a little earlier, and..."
"And you saw Mr. Dolan and me having our pleasant little chat," I said. I hoped seeing was all she'd done, that her window had been closed and she hadn't heard me whining to be let go.
"It didn't look pleasant, and it didn't look friendly," she said. "Paul, that Mr. Dolan's been asking around about you. He asked me about you last week, this was. I didn't think much about it then, just that he's got himself a nasty long nose for other people's business. But now I wonder..."
"Asking about me?" I hoped I didn't sound as uneasy as I felt. "Asking what?"
"Where you go walking, for one thing, and why you go walking."
I tried to laugh. "There's a man who doesn't believe in exercise, that much is clear."
"He thinks you've got a secret."
She paused.
"So do I."
I opened my mouth. To say what, I don't know, but Elaine raised one of her gnarled but oddly beautiful hands before I could get a single word out.
"If you do, I don't want to know what it is, Paul. Your business is your business. I was raised to think that way. But not everyone was. Be careful. That's all I want to tell you. And now I'll let you alone to do your work."
She turned to go, but before she could get out the door, I called her name. She turned back, eyes questioning. "When I finish what I'm writing," I began, then shook my head a little. That was wrong. "If I finish what I'm writing, would you read it?" She seemed to consider, then gave me the sort of smile a man could easily fall in love with, even a man as old as me.
"That would be my honor."
"You'd better wait until you read it before you talk about honor," I said. And it was Delacroix's death I was thinking of.
"I'll read it, though," she said, "every word, I promise. But you have to finish writing it first."
She left me to it. But it was a long time before I wrote anything. I sat staring out the windows for almost an hour, tapping my pen against the side of the table, watching the gray day brighten a little at a time, thinking about Brad Dolan, who calls me Polly and never tires of jokes about chinks and slopes and spicks and mix, thinking about what Elaine Connolly had said.
"He thinks you've got a secret. So do I.
And maybe I do. Yes, maybe I do. And of course Brad Dolan wants it. Not because he thinks it's important, and it's not, I guess, except to me, but because he doesn't think very old men like myself should have secrets. No taking the ponchos off the hook outside the kitchen, no secrets either. No getting the idea that the likes of us are still human. And why shouldn't we be allowed such an idea? He doesn't know. And in that, too, he is like Percy. So my thoughts, like a river that takes an oxbow turn, finally led back to where they had been when Brad Dolan reached out from beneath the kitchen eave and grabbed my wrist, to Percy. Mean-spirited Percy Wetmore, and how he had taken his revenge on the man who had laughed at him. Delacroix had been throwing the colored spool he had, the one Mr. Jingles would fetch, and had bounced out of the cell and into the corridor. That was all it took. Percy saw his chance. Chapter 2.
"No, you fool!"
Brutal yelled, but Percy paid no attention. Just as Mr. Jingles reached the spool, too intent on it to realize his old enemy was at hand, Percy brought the sole of one hard black work shoe down on him. There was an audible snap as Mr. Jingles' back broke, and blood gushed from his mouth. His tiny black eyes bulged in their sockets, and in them I read an expression of surprised agony that was all too human. Delacroix screamed with horror and grief. He threw himself at the door of his cell and thrust his arms out through the bars, reaching as far as he could, crying the mouse's name over and over. Percy turned toward him, smiling, toward me and Brutal as well. "There," he said. "I knew I'd get him, sooner or later. Just a matter of time, really." He turned and walked back up the green mile, leaving Mr. Jingles lying on the linoleum, his spreading blood red over green. Dean got up from the duty desk, hitting the side of it with his knee and knocking the cribbage board to the floor. The pegs spilled out of their holes and rolled in all directions. Neither Dean nor Harry, who had been just about to go out, paid the slightest attention to the overturn of the game.
"What did you do this time?" Dean shouted at Percy. "What the hell did you do this time, you stoopnagle?"
Percy didn't answer. He strode past the desk without saying a word, patting his hair with his fingers. He went through my office and into the storage shed. William Wharton answered for him.
"Boss Dean, I think what he did was teach a certain French fry it ain't smart to laugh at him," he said,
and then began to laugh himself. It was a good laugh, a country laugh, cheery and deep. There were people I met during that period of my life, very scary people for the most part, who only sounded normal when they laughed. Wild Bill Wharton was one of those. I looked down at the mouse again, stunned. It was still breathing, but there were minute beads of blood caught in the filaments of its whiskers, and a dull glaze was creeping over its previously brilliant oil-drop eyes. Brutal picked up the colored spool, looked at it, then looked at me. He looked as stupefied as I felt. Behind us, Delacroix went on screaming out his grief and horror. It wasn't just the mouse, of course. Percy had smashed a hole in Delacroix's defenses, and all his terror was pouring out. But Mr. Jingles was the focusing point for those pent-up feelings, and it was terrible to listen to him.
"Oh, no!"
he cried over and over again, amid the screams and the garbled pleas and prayers in Cajun French.
"Oh, no! Oh, no! Poor Mr. Jingles! Poor old Mr. Jingles! Oh, no!"
"Give him to me." I looked up, puzzled by that deep voice, at first not sure who it belonged to. I saw John Coffey. Like Delacroix, he had put his arms through the bars of his cell door, but unlike Del, he wasn't waving them around. He simply held them out as far as he could, the hands at the ends of them open. It was a purposeful pose, an almost urgent pose. And his voice had the same quality, which was why I suppose I didn't recognize it as belonging to Coffey at first.
He seemed a different man from the lost, weepy soul that had occupied this cell for the last few weeks. "Give him to me, Mr. Edgecombe, while there's still time." Then I remembered what he'd done for me and understood. I supposed it couldn't hurt, but I didn't think it would do much good either. When I picked the mouse up, I winced at the feel. There were so many splintered bones poking at various spots on Mr. Jingle's hide that it was like picking up a fur-covered pincushion. This was no urinary infection. Still... "What are you doing?" Brutal asked as I put Mr. Jingles in Coffee's huge right hand. "What the hell?" Coffee pulled the mouse back through the bars. He lay limp on Coffee's palm, tail hanging over the arc between Coffee's thumb and first finger, the tip twitching weakly in midair. Then Coffee covered his right hand with his left, creating a kind of cup in which the mouse lay. We could no longer see Mr. Jingles himself, only the tail, hanging down and twitching at the tip like a dying pendulum. Coffee lifted his hands toward his face, spreading the fingers of the right as he did so, creating spaces like those between prison bars. The tail of the mouse now hung from the side of his hands that was facing us. Brutal stepped next to me, still holding the colored spool between his own fingers. "What's he think he's doing?"
"Shh,"
I said. Delacroix had stopped screaming.
"Please, John," he whispered. "Oh, Johnny, help him. Please help him, oh, s'il vous plaît."
Dean and Harry joined us, Harry with our old deck of airplane cards still in one hand. "What's going on?" Dean asked, but I only shook my head. I was feeling hypnotized again. Damned if I wasn't. Coffee put his mouth between two of his fingers and inhaled sharply. For a moment, everything hung suspended. Then he raised his head away from his hands, and I saw the face of a man who looked desperately sick or in desperate pain. His eyes were sharp and blazing. His upper teeth bit at his full lower lip. His dark face had faded to an unpleasant color that looked like ash stirred into mud. He made a choked sound way back in his throat.
"Dear Jesus, Lord and Savior," Brutal whispered.
His eyes appeared to be in danger of dropping right out of his face.
"What?" Harry almost barked. "What?" "The tail. Don't you see it? The tail."
Mr. Jingle's tail was no longer a dying pendulum. It was snapping briskly from side to side, like the tail of a cat in a bird-catching mood. And then, from inside Coffee's cupped hands, came a perfectly familiar squeak. Coffee made that choking, gagging sound again, then turned his head to one side, like a man that has coughed up a wad of phlegm and means to spit it out. Instead, he exhaled a cloud of black insects, I think they were insects, and the others said the same, but to this day I'm not sure, from his mouth and nose. They boiled around him in a dark cloud that temporarily obscured his features.
"Christ! What are those?"
Dean asked in a shrill, scared voice. "It's all right," I heard myself say. "Don't panic, it's all right. In a few seconds they'll be gone." As when Coffee had cured my urinary infection for me, the bugs turned white and then disappeared.
"Holy shit,"
Harry whispered.
"Paul?"
Brutal asked in an unsteady voice.
"Paul?"
Coffee looked okay again, like a fellow who has successfully coughed up a wad of meat that has been choking him. He bent down, put his cupped hands on the floor, peeked through his fingers, then opened them. Mr. Jingles, absolutely all right, not a single twist to his backbone, not a single lump poking at his hide, ran out. He paused for a moment at the door of Coffee's cell, then ran across the green mile to Delacroix's cell. As he went, I noticed there were still beads of blood in his whiskers. Delacroix gathered him up, laughing and crying at the same time, covering the mouse with shameless, smacking kisses. Dean and Harry and Brutal watched with silent wonder. Then Brutal stepped forward and handed the colored spool through the bars. Delacroix didn't see it at first. He was too taken up with Mr. Jingles. He was like a father whose son has been saved from drowning. Brutal tapped him on the shoulder with the spool. Delacroix looked, saw it, took it, and went back to Mr. Jingles again, stroking his fur and devouring him with his eyes, needing to constantly refresh his perception that, yes, the mouse was all right. The mouse was whole and fine and all right. "Toss it," Brutal said. "I want to see how he runs."
"He all right, Boss Howl. He all right, praise God."
"Toss it," Brutal repeated. "Mind me, Del." Delacroix bent, clearly reluctant, clearly not wanting to let Mr. Jingles out of his hands again, at least not yet. Then very gently he tossed the spool. It rolled across the cell, past the Corona cigar box, and to the wall. Mr. Jingles was after it, but not quite with the speed he had shown previously. He appeared to be limping, just a bit, on his left rear leg. And that was what struck me the hardest. It was, I suppose, what made it real. That little limp. He got to the spool, though, got to it just fine, and nosed it back to Delacroix with all his old enthusiasm. I turned to John Coffey, who was standing at his cell door and smiling. It was a tired smile and not what I'd call really happy, but the sharp urgency I'd seen in his face as he begged for the mouse to be given to him was gone, and so was the look of pain and fear, as if he were choking. It was our John Coffey again, with his not-quite-there face and strange, far-looking eyes. "You helped it," I said. "Didn't you, big boy?" "That's right," Coffey said. The smile widened a little, and for a moment or two it was happy. "I helped it. I helped Del's mouse. I helped..." He trailed off, unable to remember the name. "Mr. Jingles," Dean said. He was looking at John with careful, wondering eyes, as if he expected Coffey to burst into flames or maybe begin to float in his cell. "That's right," Coffey said. "Mr. Jingles, he's a circus mouse, gonna live in ivy glass."
"You bet your bobcat," Harry said, joining us and looking at John Coffey.
Behind us, Delacroix lay down on his bunk with Mr. Jingles on his chest. Del was crooning to him, singing him some French song that sounded like a lullaby. Coffey looked up the green mile toward the duty desk and the door which led into my office and the storage room beyond.
"Boss Percy's bad," he said. "Boss Percy's mean. He stepped on Del's mouse. He stepped on Mr. Jingles."
And then, before we could say anything else to him, if we could have thought of anything to say, John Coffey went back to his bunk, lay down, and rolled on his side to face the wall. Chapter 3 Percy was standing with his back to us when Brutal and I came into the storage room about 20 minutes later. He had found a can of paste furniture polish on a shelf above the hamper where we put our dirty uniforms, and sometimes our civilian clothes, the prison laundry didn't care what it washed, and was polishing the oak arms and legs of the electric chair. This probably sounds bizarre to you, perhaps even macabre, but to Brutal and me it seemed the most normal thing Percy had done all night. Old Sparky would be meeting his public tomorrow, and Percy would at least appear to be in charge. "Percy," I said quietly. He turned, the little tune he'd been humming dying in his throat, and looked at us. I didn't see the fear I'd expected, at least not at first. I realized that Percy looked older somehow, and I thought John Coffey was right. He looked mean. Meanness is like an addicting drug. No one on earth is more qualified to say that than me. And I thought that after a certain amount of experimentation, Percy had gotten hooked on it. He liked what he had done to Delacroix's mouse. What he liked even more was Delacroix's dismayed screams.
"Don't start in on me," he said in a tone of voice that was almost pleasant. "I mean, hey, it was just a mouse. It never belonged here in the first place, as you boys well know."
"The mouse is fine," I said. My heart was thumping hard in my chest, but I made my voice come out mild, almost disinterested.
"Just fine. Running and squeaking and chasing its spool again. You're no better at mouse killing than you are at most of the other things you do around here."